Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Horace Gunn, Ghost Hunter. This is a story from 1891. The little hamlet of Oakville, lying 7 or 8 miles east of Statesboro, Georgia, the Savannah River, is much agitated at present over a ghostly sensation, which appears to be more substantial than is usual with such excitements, to use a paradoxical expression. About 3 weeks ago, the family of a small farmer named Walsingham began to be annoyed by certain disturbances in their household matters, which they at first attributed to the malice or mischievous propensity of some outsider. These disturbances generally took the form of noises in the house after the family had retired and the light was extinguished. Continual banging of the doors, things overturned, the doorbell rang, and the annoying of the house dog, a large and intelligent mastiff. It was the conduct of this animal that first caused the Walsinghams to believe there was something more in these occurrences than appeared on the surface, though they were reluctant to attach any supernatural significance to them. Being a family of education, practical persons, and avowed skeptics on the subject of spooks, etc. Don Caesar, the mastiff, would be seen to start suddenly from a nap and run at full tilt as if from someone, or start suddenly back while walking leisurely down a path, as if he again met with someone. But he soon lost his temper and varied these specific proceedings by snarling at every door, as if he expected an enemy to enter, and often drawing back with threatening bark and displaying fangs to warn his unseen annoyer from him. One day he was found in the hallway, barking furiously and bristling with rage, while his eyes seemed directed to the wall just before him. At last he made a spring forward with a hoarse yelp of ungovernable fury, only to fall back as if flung down by some powerful and cruel hand. Upon examination, it was found that his neck had been broken. The house cat, on the contrary, seemed rather to enjoy the favor of the ghost, and would often enter a door as if escorting some visitor in whose hand was stroking her back. She would also climb upon a chair, rubbing herself and purring, as if well pleased at the presence of someone in the seat. She and Don Caesar invariably manifested this eccentric conduct at the same time, as though the mysterious being was visible to both of them. This kept up until no doubt could be entertained that the animal saw something of a supernatural character, which was also making itself very disagreeable to the Walsinghams. It did not long content itself with petty annoyances, but finally took to rousing the family at all hours of the night by making such a row as to render any rest impossible. This noise, which consisted of shouts, groans, hideous laughter, and a peculiar, most distressing wail, would sometimes proceed apparently from under the house, sometimes from the ceiling, and at other times in the very room in which the family was seated. One night, Miss Amelia Walsingham, a young daughter, was engaged at her toilet when she felt a hand laid softly on her shoulder. Thinking it was her mother or sister, she glanced in the glass before her, only to be thunderstruck at seeing the mirror reflect no form but her own, though she could plainly see a man's broad hand lying on her arm. She brought the family to her by her screams, but when they reached her, all signs of the mysterious hand was gone. On another occasion, the girl was startled by beholding the knob of her door turn softly. The door opened and then closed as if someone had entered and shut it behind them. She strained her eyes, trying to make out some form or the cause of the phenomena, but nothing appeared. She vacated the room, however, feeling sure nothing was in it with her. Mr. Walsingham himself saw footsteps form beside his own while walking through the garden after a light rain. The marks were those of a man's naked feet and fell beside his own as if the person walked at his side. After some minutes, his steps left him, and he led towards the house where Don Caesar was lying on the front piazza. The dog sprang up, barking furiously, but retreated as the steps approached him. Matters grew so serious that the Walsinghams became frightened and talked of leaving the house when an event took place that confirmed them in this determination. The family was seated at the supper table with several guests who were spending the evening when a loud groan was heard in the room directly overhead. This was, however, nothing unusual, and very little notice was taken of it until one of the visitors pointed out a stain of what looked like blood on the white tablecloth, and it was seen that some liquid was slowly dripping on the table from the ceiling overhead. This liquid was so much like fresh shed blood as to horrify those who were watching it slowly dripping. Mr. Walsingham, with several of his guests, ran hastily upstairs and into the room directly over the one into which the blood was dripping. A carpet covered the floor, and nothing appeared to explain the source of the ghastly rain. But anxious to satisfy themselves thoroughly, the carpet was immediately ripped up and the boarding found to be perfectly dry and even covered with a thin layer of dust. And all the while the floor was being examined, the persons below could swear the blood never ceased to drip. A stain the size of a dinner plate was formed before the drop ceased to fall. This stain was examined next day under the microscope and was pronounced by competent chemists to be human blood. The Walsinghams left the house the next day, and since then the place has been apparently given over to spooks and evil spirits, which make the night hideous with a noise of revel, shouts, and furious yells. Hundreds from all over the county and adjacent have visited the place, but few have the courage to pass a night in the haunted house. One daring spirit, Horace Gunn of Savannah, however, accepted a wager that he could spend 24 hours in it, and did so, though he declares that there's not enough money in the county to make him pass another night there. He was found the morning after by his friends with whom he made the wager in an insensible condition and was with difficulty brought out of his swoon. He has never recovered from the shock of his terrible experience and is still confined to his bed suffering from nervous prostration. His story is that shortly after nightfall, he endeavored to kindle a fire in one of the rooms and to light the lamp which he had provided himself, but to his surprise and consternation found it impossible to do either. An icy breath, which seemed to proceed from some invisible person at his side, extinguished each match as he lighted it. At this particular terrifying turn of affairs, Mr. Gunn would have left the house and forfeited the amount of his wager, a considerable one, but was restrained by the fear of ridicule and of his story not being believed in. He seated himself in the dark with the calmness he could and awaited developments. For some time nothing occurred, and the young man was half dozing when, after an hour or two, he was brought to his feet by a sudden yell of pain or rage that seemed to come from under the house. This appeared to be the signal for an outbreak of hideous noises all over the house. The sound of running feet could be heard scurrying up and down the stairs, hastening from one room to another, as if one person fled from the pursuit of a second. This kept up for nearly an hour, but at last ceased altogether, and for some time Mr. Gunn sat in darkness and quiet, and had about concluded that the performance was over for the night. At last his attention was attracted by a white spot that gradually appeared on the opposite wall from him. This spot continued to brighten until it seemed a disk of white fire, when the horrified spectator saw that the light emanated from and surrounding a human head, which, without a body or any visible means of support, was moving slowly along the wall at about the height of a man from the floor. This ghastly hand appeared to be that of an aged person, though whether male or female was difficult to determine. The hair was long and gray and matted, together with dark clots of blood, which also issued from a deep, jagged wound in one temple. The cheeks were fallen in, and the whole face indicated suffering and unspeakable misery. The eyes were wide open and gleamed with an unearthly fire, while the glassy balls seemed to follow the terror-stricken Mr. Gunn, who was too thoroughly paralyzed by what he saw to move or cry out. Finally, the head disappeared, and the room was once more left in darkness. but the young man could hear what seemed to be half a dozen persons moving about him, while the whole house shook as if rocked by some violent earthquake. The groaning and wailing that broke forth from every direction was something terrific, and an unearthly rattle and banging as of china and tin pans being flung to the floor from the upper story added to the deafening noise. Gunn at last roused himself sufficiently to attempt to leave the haunted house, feeling his way along the wall in order to avoid the beings, whatever they were, that filled the room. The young man had nearly succeeded in reaching the door when he felt himself seized by the ankles and was violently thrown to the floor. He was grasped by icy hands, which sought to grip him about the throat. He struggled with his unseen foe, but was soon overpowered and choked into insensibility. When found by his friends, his throat was black with the marks of long, thin fingers armed with cruel, curved nails. The only explanation that can be found for these mysterious manifestations is that about 3 months ago, a number of bones were discovered on the Walsingham Place, which some declared even then to be those of a human being. Mr. Walsingham pronounced them, however, to be animals, and they were hastily thrown into an adjacent lime kiln. It is supposed to be the outraged spirit of the person to whom they had belonged in life that is now creating such consternation. Exorcism at St. Donat's Castle. The following story was sent to Lord Halifax by Mr. Charles G. Sterling. During 1917, Mr. Sterling, while staying in Scotland, met a Mr. X, a well-known faith healer, whose real name is divulged in the letter but is better withheld from publication. He is an unassuming man of much piety and obvious sincerity, Mr. Sterling wrote. He told me astounding tales of his experiences and exorcising haunted houses in various parts of the country. The enclosed is a literal version of what occurred at St. Donat's Castle. You may rely on this being an unembroidered and precise account, as I had from Mr. X's lips. St. Donat's Castle is a picturesque building on the coast, rather over 2 miles west of Lantwit Major. The present hall dates from the 16th century and provided a sanctuary for Archbishop Usher after the ruin of the Royalist cause at Naseby in 1645. He was invited to take refuge there by the Dowager Lady Stradling of the day, and the little chamber in which he lived for upward of a year may still be seen. For some time, the inhabitants of St. Donat's Castle have been greatly alarmed by a variety of ghostly phenomena, which appeared by day as well as by night. The materialization which occurred scared not only the servants and the children of the house, but also the owner and his wife. The situation at length became so intolerable that the owner, a retired naval officer, decided to let or sell the place, which accordingly was advertised in Country Life. At this juncture, however, he happened to hear of the fame of Mr. X as an exorcist. Mr. X is a remarkable man, born in one of the dominions, who at the age of 14 discovered that he possessed extraordinary powers of healing. His record of cases is amazing. He devotes his life to healing the sick and to casting out evil spirits from individuals and from haunted houses. Informed of Mr. X's gifts, the owner of St. Donat's wrote to him and invited him to pay a visit to the castle and investigate the phenomena which were giving such trouble. Mr. X consented and in due course arrived. He found that the principal manifestations were as followed. 1. A panther was repeatedly seen by the household in the corridors. 2. A bright light appeared nightly in one of the bedrooms, having the semblance of a large, glaring eye. 3. A hag of horrible appearance was seen in the armory. 4. The piano, even when closed, was played by invisible hands. Having received this account of the manifestations, Mr. X retired to the bedroom in which the light had been reported, to pray and grapple with the powers of darkness. He requested the owner of the house to sit meanwhile in the hall with the front door wide open while the process of exorcism went on. After a while, as though to mark Mr. X's triumph over the evil forces of the place, a great gust of wind suddenly blew out from the room where he was praying, swept down the main staircase, and all but carried the owner of the castle into the garden. From that day and hour, the ghostly disturbances completely ceased. All was peaceful in the castle, which is no longer to be let or sold. What the gardener saw. This story was sent to Lord Halifax by Mrs. J. Rawlinson Ford of Yealand Conyers, Carnforth, Cumberland. She added in a postscript, "Of course, I could give the name of the lady and the house, but I am not sure that I may. The present occupiers may not know about the ghost." The letter was written in February 1914. A curious instance of an appearance just before or at the moment of death took place some years ago at a place about 30 miles or so from here, Carnforth. One day the gardener at this place was at work in the garden when he happened, for some reason, to turn around. To his great surprise, he saw his mistress coming towards him, apparently in distress and wanting his help. His astonishment was the greater, as at the time she was very ill, and he believed her to be in bed. As he hurried towards her, she unaccountably disappeared, and when in bewilderment he went on to the house and made inquiries, he was told that she had just died in her room upstairs. There was a sequel, which may be held to explain the apparition. Years afterwards, the lady's maid, on her deathbed, confessed that she had murdered her mistress. Having discovered that the lady had left her some money in her will, she had given her poison. Thereafter, the lady was supposed to haunt the house. I stayed there more than once and always felt, as people say, eerie on the staircase and landing, but not when I was in my room. On the death of my host, his wife and child left the house and it went out of the family. Not very long ago, I was speaking to my former hostess about ghost and asked which was the actual room at the hall where the lady was murdered. She replied that it was the one in which I had slept. Since I never had any uncanny feeling while in it, I suppose that my discomfort on the landing and staircase must have been caused by the old pictures and furniture and the dark corners, and that the ghost of the murdered woman had nothing to do with it. Three in a Bed. Three in a Bed was evidently an old favorite with Lord Halifax. In the early days of his marriage, when he lived at the Moulton, Devonshire, he used to tell the story to his visitors with great effect. Towards the end of his life, he must have found that he could not recall the details, as he seems to have written to one of the visitors of those early days and asked her to refresh his memory. And complying with his request, she reminded him how you used to make us shudder when you related the story. What particularly haunted me was the fear afterwards of touching something cold. A certain dissenting minister and his wife took a large house near a town in one of the eastern counties. After they had been there a little while, were disquieted to observe that although they were not using the upper floor of the house, often when they came home at night after evening service, they used to see lights in the upper windows. One day an old friend came to stay with them for a few days, and since there was no other accommodation for him in the house, they put him to sleep in one of the rooms on the top floor at the end of a passage. On the morning after the first night of his stay, the visitor came down to breakfast looking very pale and harassed. He found, he told his host, that he had to leave at once, and although they pressed him to remain, nothing would shake his determination to depart without delay, nor although they questioned him, would he give any explanation of his sudden change of plan. A little later on, a young couple arrived as guests. They were given the same room as the previous visitor had had. When they retired to bed, there was a bright fire burning, and there was nothing to disquiet them. They settled themselves for the night and soon fell asleep. Presently the man awoke with a start and a strong feeling that he was lying between two people. So certain was he of this that he dared not put out his hand on the opposite side to that on which his wife was lying. Instead, very cautiously, he roused his wife and persuaded her to get out of the bed on the far side. He followed her, and then looking back, they both distinctly saw by the light of the fire the bedclothes heaped up, as if it were, round the human form which lay in the bed. As they stared, they heard footsteps coming slowly and softly down the passage outside. They reached the door and stopped. After a moment's pause, the brass handle turned and the door, which had been locked, swung gently open. The unfortunate couple hid their eyes in terror, so they saw nothing of what immediately followed. But they heard her footsteps pad softly across the room. There was silence and then a dreadful gurgle, and looking at the bed once more, they saw the clothes twitched right off it onto the floor. Once more, the footsteps retreated to the door and died away down the passage. The rest of the night was spent in fear and watchfulness, and when next morning the maid arrived with her hot water, the door was still locked. Coming down to breakfast in great agitation, they told her experience to their host, who wrote off at once to his previous visitor. In his reply, the latter admitted that he had had a precisely similar experience. No explanation of any kind was forthcoming, and needless to say, the house was given up. The Simla Bungalow. The story of the Simla Bungalow was sent to Lord Halifax in 1925 by his sister, Mrs. Dundas, who had it from her granddaughter in India. The other day, while I was staying with friends at Simla, I met a very charming Mrs. Giles. She had been a Miss Fordyce, and before marriage had lived up there with her mother and stepfather in a house not occupied by an American doctor. It was an old building, and after a little while they began to have complaints of nocturnal disturbances. Two of their guests, a man and a girl, reported that the most extraordinary noises had prevented them from sleeping, and although Miss Fordyce assured them that they must have heard were rats scampering about, they were quite unconvinced by the explanation and continued to be very upset. A little afterwards, Miss Fordyce and her mother, who was not at all well at the time, were alone in the house. One night, Miss Fordyce was awakened by the agonized whimpers of her fox terrier, which always slept near her bed. The dog jumped up onto the eiderdown and seemed to be trying in terror to crawl under it. Miss Fordyce always kept a light burning, and she sat up in bed at once and looked round to see what could have frightened her dog. The room, as is quite usual in India, was an inner one with a dressing room leading out of it. The dressing room door was open, and looking through it, she saw standing on the step in the outer doorway an old man leaning upon a stick and staring at the floor. As she looked, he vanished. Curiously enough, in spite of this alarm, she was able to lie down quite calmly and go to sleep again. Next day, however, thinking over her adventure, she felt very frightened. Owing to her mother's illness, she did not like to tell her what she had seen, and felt obliged to continue sleeping in the room. But the fox terrier would never enter it alone again, and if it happened to get shut in there, would howl terribly until released. Long afterwards, when she was at a luncheon party, Miss Fordyce found herself sitting next to a young man who told her that his parents had once lived in that identical house and that it was haunted. He was also able to explain the haunting. An old man, he said, had once lived in the house with a young wife, and one night, in a fit of jealousy, he had murdered her. Many people had heard noises. Some had even seen the ghost of the young wife running along the covered veranda, crying, but as far as is known, Miss Fordyce is the only person who ever saw the old man. The Cardinal at Waverley Abbey. Waverley Abbey is close to the River Wey, about 3 miles from Farnham. Founded in 1128, it was the first Cistercian establishment in England, though little of the original building now remains. The cardinal of the story may have been Peter de Rupibus, the famous Bishop of Winchester, of whom it is recorded that his heart and bowels were buried in the Abbey Church, while the rest of his body lies in Winchester Cathedral. What was supposed to be his heart was discovered in 1731 within two leaden dishes soldered together. His subsequent fate is unknown. The following story was sent to Lord Halifax in 1925 by Mrs. Anderson, the owner of Waverley Abbey. Mrs. Dundas left us this morning. She had been staying with us for the last week and made me promise to write you the following little story of what occurred here during the war, when a house was turned into a hospital for wounded men. We had beds here for 250 wounded. The Bishop of Winchester, Dr. Talbot, was our chaplain. A Father Robo looked after the Roman Catholics, and a dissenting minister from Farnham attended to the nonconformists. I always made a point of sending the Roman Catholics into the church at Farnham for Mass, but the little room that used to be my sitting room was also turned into a chapel for the use of those who were unable to make the journey. Father Robo would come here as often as he liked. He always had lunch with us in the staff room, and we became great friends. One Easter, he told me that he wanted to have high mass in my little sitting room. This had never previously been allowed in a house belonging to Church of England people, but he had obtained permission for the service from the Pope and recognition of what we had done for the Roman Catholic wounded. It had always been supposed that the abbey was haunted by the ghost of a cardinal, who some declared they had seen walking about the place. He was one of those who had been buried in the old Cistercian building and should have been prayed for in perpetuity. He frequently appeared in the large drawing room where we had 18 beds for the wounded. They and the nurses continually saw him, and this happened when they were all together, so that the apparition could not be explained away as proceeding from the imagination of a single person. The general belief was that the abbey was under a curse, as having been the property of the church and stolen from her. The priest had invited me to be at Mass that Easter morning, and consequently, I heard the address which he gave to the men after it was over. He told them that he had the message from the Pope through the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Bourne. His Holiness had sent word that in appreciation for what we had done for his flock, he had removed the curse from Waverley Abbey, that we were to pray for the Cardinal, which thereupon we did, after which his soul could rest in peace. This happened 7 or 8 years ago, and since that day, the Cardinal has not been seen again. I was in Rome last April. The present Pope knows all about the story and graciously sent for me to have an audience with him, which I much appreciated. Ghostly Guardians, someone by his side. Mrs. Ford of Carnforth had this story from her mother-in-law. One stormy night, a man known to be of great help to those who were distressed in body or mind was startled by a loud ring at his bell. Going to the door, he found a messenger from an invalid living some miles off who was in grave trouble and begged for this man to go and see him. I have forgotten the invalid's name and am not sure whether or not he was a relation. The man dismissed the messenger, saying he would go as soon as he could. As he was starting off, he hesitated and even thought of giving up the journey. It was a terrible night, and the storm had increased to such a pitch that there was a risk of his lantern light being blown out. However, he went. With the intense darkness and the wind and rain, he had some difficulty in walking along, but presently he had a curious feeling as if someone by his side. He could neither see nor hear anyone, but the sensation that he had a companion was extremely strong and continued until he arrived at his destination, where he stayed for some time. On his way home, the storm was as bad as ever, but he again had the feeling of being accompanied. Yet mysterious and unaccountable as it was, he was not in the least afraid. Many years afterwards, he had a request one day to visit a prison where a man was condemned to be hanged. He was not surprised at receiving such a message, as he was often called at that particular prison to bring comfort and help to its inmates. He found the man who had sent for him. The prisoner said that he did not wish to die with any crime unconfessed, whether or not it had been actually carried out. "Do you remember," he asked, "walking along a dark, lonely road in a storm several years ago?" The visitor replied that he did. "I knew you had been sent for to a dying person," the prisoner went on, "and that you always wore a valuable watch and might have money on you. I lurked under a hedge prepared to attack and rob you. But as you walked along, someone else was walking with you. So I waited for your return. But when you came back, the person was still there, walking by your side. And I dare not attack two people." Bishop King's Escape. The story of the escape of Edward King, Bishop of Lincoln, was sent to the present Lord Halifax by Miss A. E. Nash. It is so similar to the preceding tale that very possibly it refers to the same incident. The bishop told his story at tea one day to Canon Perry, his daughters, and Miss Nash's sister. "I do not know if you have ever heard of our dear Bishop King of Lincoln's experience. He told it to Canon Perry when my sister was staying with him and the bishop came to tea, as at that time he often did in order to consult with him on canon law, when those creatures were prosecuting him. When the bishop was a young man, he was curate in a village, one wet, cold night. He had come home very tired and had just got his boots off when his landlady came in and said that a farmer living 3 miles off across the fields had met with a serious accident and wanted King to come at once. She did not know the messenger, and he refused to come in because he was so wet. King put his boots on again and started off, but it was very dark and he missed the man who had brought the message. When he reached the house to which he had been summoned, the door was opened to his knock by the farmer himself, hale, hearty, and much surprised to see his visitor. No message had been sent, and greatly mystified, King went home. The man who had summoned him had gone, and the matter remained unexplained. Some years afterward, in another county, King was ministering to a dying man in the hospital, and the man said, "Don't you remember me, sir?" The bishop could not recall him until he gave his name, which was that of a very bad character who had lived years ago in that village where King was curate. The man went on, "It was lucky for you that you brought a friend with you that night when you thought you had a call to the farm. I meant to murder you, only I couldn't, as there were two of you." The bishop had seen and heard nothing, but the man was certain that he had been accompanied by a second great-coated figure walking beside him. A similar occurrence was told me by a young priest who was working in a mining district in Canada. He had to go a long ride through thickly wooded country. He did not relish the job, as there were plenty of undesirable characters about, but duty called, and he went, returning in perfect safety. Some little while afterwards, he was called to see a dying man in hospital, who told him that he and a pal had been so furious with him for his interference with their doings that they determined to kill him. Knowing of his journey, they had lain in wait with him in the loneliest part of the way, but to their great annoyance, two other men were riding, one on each side of their proposed victim, so that they could not get a shot at him. Like Bishop King, the priest thought that he was alone.